Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Philippa McGuinness makes her first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Philippa McGuinness is an acclaimed non-fiction publisher who has been commissioning books of history, politics and current affairs and biography and memoir, many of them prize winners, for almost a quarter of a century. She's the editor of Copy Fright, published in 2015, and she's been published in The Guardian, Mianjin and elsewhere, and she appears on panels and at writers' festivals, and there you go. But this is the occasion of the publication of her first book, as the thing from writing book, The Year Everything Changed, 2001. And tonight our topic is, for Ms. McGuinness, 2001, The Year That Changed Everything. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you to Anne Henderson and Jared Henderson for the invitation to speak here tonight. Standing in a tower named after our first governor prompts me to acknowledge the original inhabitants of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present. I know I'm in good company as a Sydney Institute speaker, not least because many of my own authors have spoken here, including Kath Bishop. I seem to be echoing.
Yeah.
Kath Bishop, about businesswomen in colonial Sydney only last week. And as with so many things I have experienced as a publisher turned author, it's interesting to find the shoe on the other foot. For the next 30 minutes, I'm going to talk about how I came to write The Year Everything Changed, 2001, why I structured the book the way I did, what I discovered as I wrote it, and why I argue that the world did indeed change in 2001. The book covers a lot of ground, as indeed will this talk. Of course, you'll get a much better sense of what that ground is, how it shifts, and how I go about carving pieces of it out from reading the book itself, rather than from me talking about it tonight. But I hope what follows will be a taster and an evocative reminder of the year that was 2001 and what it was like to be there. Early in 2014, I went to a conference to honour historian Professor Alan Atkinson that was held at the ANU in Canberra. I was there as the publisher of the third volume of Alan's landmark trilogy, The Europeans in Australia. And because I had negotiated to republish the first two volumes, which had been out of print for some time. The collective noun for historians is an argumentation. So I found myself in a lecture theatre in Canberra, seated in a row in the middle of an argumentation, listening to many of the historians present talking about the books they had written and published for the bicentennial celebrations in 1988. The historians referred to these as slice histories, books that took a particular year as a snapshot and wove a narrative around it. I had one of the books they were referring to on my shelf at home, Australians 1838. Other volumes followed, covering a year every 50 years, Australians 1888, Australians 1938, for example. And this got me thinking about the publishing conceit that takes a particular year, usually what we might call a blockbuster year, say 1492 or 1776 or 1939, and uses it as a narrative device, both revisiting what happened and drawing out themes to determine what it all meant. I started thinking about more recent years that seemed packed with momentous events. Years of shifts that felt seismic, even as they were happening. 1989 is a big year, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, Tiananmen Square, and the death of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. Not to mention the so-called end of history that this all brought. 1989 certainly sprung to mind, but I quickly settled on 2001 as I sat there in that lecture theatre. I began to list all the things I could think of that happened that year. 9/11 was the most obvious event. There are few incidents when the majority of people can match a day, month, and year to a particular event, let alone recall, often with what we might call a sense memory, exactly where they were at the very moment they watched passenger aeroplanes fly into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Centers in New York City. My off-the-top-of-the-head list of 2001 events grew very quickly, even beyond 9/11 that was at the top. I included Tampa, the Norwegian freighter that rescued a boatload of asylum seekers and became a household word almost overnight, not to mention shorthand for divisive debates and policies in regard to refugees. Another item on my list was the re-election of John Howard in November, in a charged election that pundits and the voters themselves had assumed for most of the year leading up to it that Kim Beazley would win. Another item was the inauguration of George W. Bush as US president in January, an election that many American voters saw as illegitimate. I also wrote the word Afghanistan, it being the continuation of what seemed like a never-ending war, but now Australian troops were involved too, fighting against the Taliban. I confess, as I made this list, I didn't remember the collapse of ANSET, HIH, OneTel, and the American energy company Enron that year. I probably never knew that Wikipedia had launched early in 2001, but later was pleased to discover that it had, not least when I met a young Wikipedian. Similarly, I didn't remember that Steve Jobs launched the iPod in 2001, nor did I know it was named after the pod doors that the computer, HAL, refused to open in the film 2001: A Space Odyssey. In the book, I argue that the iPod was the precursor to the smartphones we all have in our pockets now, the phones that changed how we live and how we interact with each other. My day job as a publisher is to find authors to write books. At this point in my random list-making as I sat in the ANU Lecture Theatre, my thoughts would have been about to head down the path of thinking about which potential writers might be good to talk to about this project. Who wouldn't want to write a history of 2001? And I hoped I would sign someone up to do it. Then I remembered, not that I ever forget, the personal tragedy my family experienced that year. At the full term of my pregnancy, my son Daniel was stillborn. We buried him in the Lawn Cemetery in Singapore on New Year's Eve, the last day of 2001. In that moment, I resolved to write the book myself. A decision that was, in fact, terrifying and exhilarating at once. I knew I could write. Having published hundreds of other books had been a great lesson in what to do and what not to do. But I certainly didn't think of myself as a writer. I knew I wouldn't write a dispassionate academic account, but something more discursive and, I hoped, engaging. I also knew that it had to blend the personal with the public and the political. I had some ambivalence about making myself a subject in the history I was writing, but I knew my own story would be a relatively small part of a year packed with stories. I knew I wanted to write about big political figures, Bush, Blair, Bin Laden, Berlusconi, but also everyday people. Some of those I discovered through my interviews made the book even more enjoyable to research and write, as we'll see. The contract I signed to write the book with Penguin Random House, not my own employer, I hasten to add, had this as its title-subtitle combo. 2001, the year everything changed, with a question mark. The publisher in me knew that that question mark was a bit of a downer. For better or worse, readers respond to something authoritative with clearly expressed opinions that come down on one side or the other. But the fledgling historian in me wanted to keep that question mark. As I launched into researching and writing, I didn't know the answer to my question of inquiry and wanted to keep an open mind. But, spoiler alert, not too far into my research, I dropped the question mark for reasons that, as I explain, emerged from what was genuine inquiry. But first, I want to talk about my approach to research. It was random in some ways, and in other ways, highly systematic. I say random because I saw every single person I crossed paths with as a potential source. Except for the children among us, and I don't think there are any children here tonight, we were all there in 2001. Even my wonderful 30-year-old editor, in high school at the time, remembered being called out of bed by her mum to sit up and watch Sandra Sully's coverage of 9/11 on Channel 10. Like all of us, she had a sense that history was being made. So my wide networks of friends, family, authors, colleagues and acquaintances led me to all kinds of introductions, insights and observations. I received many of these unprompted. I would answer, in response to a question asking me what my book was about, that it was a history of the year 2001. I'm here to tell you that 9 out of 10 people would launch into a story about where they were on 9/11. To mention but one example of many, it turned out that one of these people I found myself talking to at a function at my son's high school didn't watch this catastrophe unfold on screen, but in person, because he worked nearby, on Wall Street. One recollection of his that I find very poignant ended up in the book. But most of my research was more systematic than random conversations. I knew I wanted to interview former Prime Minister John Howard and then Labour opposition leader Kim Beazley, and I did. I didn't expect that I would spend hundreds of hours sitting in the State Library of New South Wales going through newspapers. But I did. One Australian newspaper in full for each day of the year. I used microfilm so I could see the way the articles were presented on the page as they were published, the order they appeared, and the photographs that accompanied them. It's also worth noting that not every article from every newspaper gets digitised for reasons to do with administration rather than censorship or copyright. I did this work at the suggestion of historian Professor Mark McKenna, and it was brilliant advice. Newspapers were so much more extensive then, packed with so many display advertisements and columns of classifieds that revisiting them in their entirety felt like spending time with historical relics in more ways than one. Doing this work meant I could immerse myself in the moods and textures of 2001 and try to recreate them on the page. I would read a week of The Australian and then switch to The Age or The Sydney Morning Herald or The Herald Sun to mix it up and make sure I was reading a multiplicity of views. I also read many overseas newspapers, particularly The New York Times. Essential for a book that doesn't only take an Australian perspective. Indeed, for most of 2001, I myself was living in Singapore. It also meant that I came across stories covered at length in the pages of our newspapers that I might not have otherwise picked up on if my research had been a little less granular. Not that the book claims to be comprehensive. That would be impossible. There are thousands of examples of less obvious stories that I might point to, but one struck me to such a degree that I ended up writing about it in my chapter on demography. AIDS was very big news in 2001, to a degree I, and I suspect all of us, have forgotten. The Australian newspapers devoted thousands of words to the crisis, which in 2001 was the number one cause of death by infectious disease in the developing world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. In the West, thanks to public health programs and treatment advances, AIDS was under control. Indeed, I quote Professor David Cooper, director of the National Centre in HIV Epidemiology in Sydney, who died only in March this year, when he said, "I don't think there has been a disease in history which in such a short time has seen the development of treatments so quickly and so successfully." One central strand of the anti-globalisation protests that swept the world in 2001, notably in Genoa, in Italy, was directed at drug companies. Protesters sought to make antiretroviral drugs that treat AIDS cheaper for developing countries. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan convened a special General Assembly session in June 2001 to confront the AIDS crisis. He called for a war on AIDS. Months later, of course, the phrase "war on terror" would become something we heard at least daily. But it's worth remembering that late in 2001, Kofi Annan and the UN were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, in part for their efforts in fighting HIV/AIDS. Another thing I think that many of us have forgotten about is the impact of the collapse of ANZUS. This is in part because it happened at the same time as 9/11. For weeks from the middle of September 2001, the newspapers had regular pages plus wraparound supplements about the terror attacks in New York and Washington that ran to thousands of words, often within a single edition of the paper. The sheer volume of material on the attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the backgrounds of the hijackers, the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden, that ran in these newspapers day after day is extraordinary. As you can imagine, this volume of material made writing about 9/11 somewhat overwhelming. But at the same time, as well as this, we had extensive features about the collapse of ANZUS. ANZUS went into administration and its planes were grounded on the 14th of September. The press conference that Prime Minister Howard held at the Willard Hotel in Washington just before smoke started rising from the Pentagon was primarily about troubles with ANZUS and the federal court's decision to let the refugees aboard the Tampa land on Australian soil, a decision that was promptly overturned. The collapse of this airline, though not entirely unexpected, still had a psychic shock on Australians. It added to the sense that everything was falling apart. As I said, there was a dedicated supplement devoted to covering the ANZUS fallout in the broadsheet papers, particularly The Australian, for weeks and weeks after its collapse. For ANZUS was a prestigious airline with a long and illustrious history. Its passengers were devastated, and not just because they were all going to lose their Golden Wing air miles. Thousands of Australian travellers were stranded in airports across the country when the fleet was grounded, by coincidence at the same time that thousands of international travellers were stranded themselves because the whole of the United States had become a no-fly zone. I found it moving and eye-opening talking to former ANZUS employees. They still refer to each other to this day as being part of the ANZUS family. Many stay connected through Facebook They have reunions on cruise boats where they wear their old uniforms. So I've talked here briefly about two subjects I tackle in the book, the global AIDS crisis and the collapse of ANZUS. I've mentioned in passing some of the other stories I tell, though I haven't referred to the centenary of Federation, the history wars for which the opening of the National Museum in Canberra opened a new front, the death of John Bradman, or the rise of two new presidents with an awful lot in common in Southeast Asia, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo and Megawati Sukarno Putri. How do I organise all this material? The book is chronological and thematic. I didn't want it to be a timeline or some kind of almanac. It's narrative history, not a chronological assembly of facts. So its 12 chapters for 12 months of the year are broadly thematic. They are devoted to commemoration, identity, celebrity, technology, religion, money, war, politics, and much in between. Both September and December essentially focus on a single day each, one that I did decide changed the whole world, and another that changed my world. So why did the book become called The Year Everything Changed at all, let alone it having a title with no question mark? I aim to build a case for my argument throughout the book. The relaxed complacency at the start of the year, when most ordinary people were not too bothered about the centenary of Federation, is in marked contrast to the end of the year. By then, we have become fearful about Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks. We're checking in on terror threats and their level on Fox News, not knowing if there will be more attacks. We're worrying about whether the US forces and their allies have managed to take Kandahar in the south of Afghanistan, when Osama bin Laden might be found, and what the source of the anthrax scare is. And, indeed, in the conclusion to the book, fear is one of the three areas I posit that reveal that everything did change. I write that the Cold War may have been over, but that September 11 rebooted our imaginations. Polarisation is another change. I also argue that we became more polarised, possibly less so in Australia than in the US, where their president proclaimed, "You're either with us or you're with the terrorists." Our own Prime Minister announced at the Liberal Party's campaign launch, "We will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come," a proclamation that worked as a highly effective, if unofficial, election slogan. In the book, I note that polarisation can be codified and argue that the US Patriot Act was an example of this. The American Civil Liberties Union stated that that act turned citizens into suspects, and not only in security screening queues at airports. Time and the way it's sped up is the third broad way I argue that everything changed at the turn of the millennium. The pace and the high stakes of the 2001 story that I tell pick up from August with Tampa, 9/11, the Australian election, the war in Afghanistan. And I point out that digital technology and the explosion and fragmentation of news platforms sped up the news stories and general information we are bombarded with now. The big four, the big tech four, are a big part of my book. Hard as it may be to believe, in light of what happened that year and what has happened since, I end the book on an optimistic note. I'm a realist, but I point out that the lessons of 2001, particularly those that relate to democracy, tolerance, and resilience, demand to be revisited and remembered by all of us. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Philip. Now, we've got copies of the year Everything Changed 2001 by Philip McGuinness, and we'll be selling them after the event. And I'm sure our speaker will be happy to sign them. So we come to questions and discussion, and we've got plenty of time. I've glanced at your book and reviewed your book in the Sydney Review online, so I've read, I'm familiar with the book, and I've looked at certain chapters of it. To what extent is it sort of, in some of the regards, sort of a look in not a, some of the areas, a looking back without some judgment? I mean, you take Ansett. I lost hundreds of thousands of miles when Ansett went under. So did it. Literally. And it's sad that people lost their jobs, and Kim Beazley went to the airport at Sydney and said, I will get you flying, which I think is probably the most, I like Kim, but it's one of the most irresponsible promises ever made in politics, because that company was a disaster. I mean, they couldn't maintain their planes. They had the most expensive, operation, much more expensive than Qantas. They couldn't maintain their planes. Their service fell apart. The company just deteriorated. So to what extent does that, I mean, does that some, say something about 2001, or does it just say something about that if a company is rotten, it goes broke? I mean, what's the message out of Ansett?
There are many messages. There's no question that Ansett was poorly managed. The Ansett disaster, as I said in the talk, didn't come out of nowhere. I mean, I'm sure many people will remember that even around Easter of that year, the fleet was grounded because of safety concerns. It was a kind of a rolling, or I should say a flying disaster. What I think, and in the book I don't go into the ins and outs of the problems with management, which did not start, as I say, in 2001. But it was the way in which that story was covered at the time. As I said, it really took up thousands and thousands of words of newsprint, as there was a lot of debate about whether Ansett would fly again. You know, there were many possibilities that seemed on the verge of taking off, excuse the metaphor, one with Lindsay Fox and Solomon Liu being a case in point. So there are, as there should be, many books written about the decline of Ansett. But what really struck me, as I say, was the impact that it had as a news story. It was huge. I thought, you know, if somebody just wanted to write about the way Ansett was covered in 2001, let me tell you, there's a lot of material for them to deal with. But the other thing that really struck me was because its collapse, the grounding of its entire fleet, coincided pretty much, as I say, with 9/11, it really did feel like the world was ending. You know, that I think people already had a sense that anything could happen with the new threat of terrorism that happened in ways we had never imagined, but that this long-standing company for which millions of people had felt very loyal, that could collapse overnight, that had a big impact on everyday people, not to mention the 16,000 people who lost their jobs. It was the biggest single job loss count in a day in Australia's history.
So, anyone? I can walk across the table because there's no. You just come back here. Yeah.
Philip, your book reminds me very much of a year book that I read a number of years ago, 1913, which was a wonderful description of what you said was happening just before 2001, the benign sense of the world in 1913, which of course we all know what happened in the following year. Some of the comments that you've made today really emphasize in your last comments about ANSET about how the media, public society, is so focused on today's events, and particularly when they're thinking about something that has been something they participated in, so they have a personal interest, they're involved in, they've lost their frequent flyer points, but more importantly, it was part of the social fabric to know the history of ANSET and what Rad Jansen did in establishing that company. But the thing that concerns me, and I'd like your feelings on this one, is that I think there is something happening today of equal moment, it will be proved in hindsight in the years to come, that is given negligible attention in the media and by politicians. And I'm wondering if you think, when you looked at 2001, whether there was anything similar at that time. And what I'm talking about is artificial intelligence and how that is having profound effects. I read very recently 70 to 80% of manufacturing jobs lost in the United States didn't get lost because of what I thought were Chinese inexpensive imports, but to artificial intelligence and the robots that have developed over time. So my question really is, what did you see in 2001 in all of your research that might have been more or less hidden from the public discussion and debate that we now realise these years later was really alive and well, but just starting to grow?
That's a very good and challenging question. I'm obviously good at making lists in my head because a long list of possibilities is occurring to me now. I'll mention three. One of them would be artificial intelligence, and because I write about HAL, the computer, in 2001, which I think, along with screens, which is the other thing I will talk about, are the most prescient elements of that film, which really was ahead of its time. It was made in 1968. You'll know that this is the 50th anniversary of it. And Kubrick, Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote the film, thought we would all be living in space. By 2001 at the latest, they said, we will all be living in space. That obviously didn't happen and still hasn't. 17 years later. But the use of screens in that film is really interesting. And in the technology chapter in the book, I write about the fact we all had what we thought were, you know, phones that would be as good as it would get, you know, our Nokias in our pocket, not realising that within, what is it, 5 or 6 years, I think the iPhone was released in 2007, we would be slaves to our phones to a degree that we couldn't have imagined. And the apps that come with those phones, which I think are a form of artificial intelligence, would disrupt, to use the word that the technology companies use, the world in ways that I don't think we are beginning to understand. So that's one thing. So the use of screens, artificial intelligence. The third thing is climate change. I really think that even looking back now, when we look at the impact that George W. Bush and later Howard had on quashing, really, the Kyoto Protocol, I would imagine that if anybody writes a book called 3001, they'll be thinking, what were you thinking? Why didn't you pay attention? You had a moment then. There are about 10 other things I could list, many of them to do with the Arabic-speaking world. I think we squandered a lot of opportunities in the lead-up to 9/11 and beyond. But yeah, that's a start.
Thank you for being amongst us and continuing a thread of that conversation from our colleague on the left. It seems to me that what you have in your research, and that hasn't been published, but you've got a book, but you've also got the data, and it seems to me that it's the rapidity of change. Now, the rapidity of change, as I postulate to you, is that it puts all of our institutions, our parliaments and our law courts, under great pressure because of this rapidity of change. Wherever that change comes from, collectively, it's very threatening. Would you like to comment?
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned time, and there's no question that we have a sense, because of the digital world, that time has sped up. And that has had an impact on the way that we receive information and process news. I think that if we're talking about institutions, if we can think of the Fourth Estate, the media as one of our institutions, the transformations to the media, partly because of big tech, but also because of the speeding up of the news cycle, have been extraordinary. And really not terribly beneficial, either because there are fewer people employed by the media, but also because we don't pay attention to major stories because we're on to the next one. The pressure on our... this is a big question. The pressure on the law, I think, is particularly pointed, and that one way I touch on this in the book is because of anti-terrorism legislation. There is a tension between needing to respond to dramatic shifts in the way that terrorism manifests and protecting civil liberties, and I don't think that our institutions have caught up with that because those changes have been very fast.
I guess you were saying that the papers seemed thicker in those days. What did the papers talk about then that they don't talk so much about now?
Everything. It's hard to know where to begin because the coverage of everything was more extensive, it was more sustained, it was more varied. And it was all funded by the ads that are no longer there. So just to use one example, I think, I can't remember, I did actually write down the numbers, but the numbers of foreign correspondents that the Australian papers had overseas now just seems extraordinary. You know, I would say Fairfax has, what, four, maybe five correspondents, you know, in key hotspots or political centres. Back then, The Age probably had 10. The Sydney Morning Herald had another 10. The Australian had I don't know how many. All the broadcasters had more foreign correspondents than they do now. That generated a lot of copy. It generated a lot of perspectives. Many people would argue now, well, you know, I can access the New York Times or the Times of London or any newspaper in the world online so easily. I can still read all those stories. But I think there is something profoundly important about being able to read a story about anything, whether it's AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa or what the UN is doing, through the lens of a correspondent who you get to know. You know what their interests and their concerns are, and it's often through an Australian lens. Not always, but it often is. And I think that's really, it's a profound loss.
You told us that in 1,000 years' time, the world, I assume there will be a world, will look back poorly on George W. Bush and John Howard, but tell us about how John Howard and Kim Beazley look back on themselves. I mean, you interviewed both of them. What were they thinking about 2001?
Yeah, that's a good question. I very much enjoyed talking to both of them and learned a lot. I have to say, and this will probably surprise no one in this room, that Kim Beazley was more reflective on what happened that year, and Howard was very interesting, but basically he was saying now what he said then. It seemed to me that everything that has happened in between did not prompt a major shift in attitude or opinion. Having said that, I would say there would be very few prime ministers or political leaders anywhere who really change their narrative very much. That's how they get there in the first place, by having a fixed narrative and sticking to it. But I found it very interesting to talk to Beazley because he had been the Australian ambassador in Washington for, I think, 6 or maybe 8 years. And he had a very particular view on the impact that 2001 had, obviously militarily, but also economically on the US. So that, for example, the tax cuts that George Bush introduced in 2001 that were highly criticised at the time, he says were absolutely catastrophic for the economy. And there are a number of economists, not just people like Paul Krugman, other more conservative economists who back him up on that.
You've spoken about artificial intelligence, and you've also spoken of terrorism. 2001 was 1 year after the Y2K bug. Was there any reference in your work to that, please?
There was, and there had to be, because you know how I said 9 out of 10 people referred to 9/11 when I said, oh, I'm writing a book about 2001? 1 in 10 referred to Y2K. And they would go, oh, my God, the Y2K bug. And I'd go, that was the year before, and it didn't happen. So it's funny the way we remember or don't remember things. But, yeah, I found myself explaining, you know, the fact that the Y2K bug actually was prevented, you know. It didn't happen, to quite a few people who thought that it had.
But, I mean, there was a sense of doom. I remember a prominent ABC reporter telling me in September that planes would be falling out of the sky, that water supplies would stop, that engines would cease and computers would go, and you wouldn't have to be on an ANZAC plane to crash at Sydney Airport. So, I mean, there was a huge scare campaign about it all, and we all woke up the next morning, if we had a hangover, probably on the 1st of November, 1st of January, and nothing had happened. So perhaps we didn't prevent it. Perhaps it never was going to happen.
Did you lose your memory over that thing?
What was the question?
How old are you now?
Historians would call that millenarianism. So when there's a big sense that the turn of the millennium is going to be all about doom and gloom and catastrophe and, you know, end times, what I end up saying in the book is that there are a lot of people, mathematicians, who say the new millennium didn't start till 2001. Anyway, I'm not going there. I don't want to engage with that. But in symbolically, at least, the new millennium, I think, started on September the 11th, 2001.
So, Anne.
Philippa, 2001, 9/11 and all of that, I can remember Jared came upstairs and we watched it on Foxtel. Now, we had Foxtel. But a tragedy like the burning of that tower of apartments in London about a year ago, To some extent, it hasn't really changed. It's just that more people have got to see it. Because what happened with 9/11 was it was almost like it was scripted to go on television. Like they deliberately flew the planes where they flew them to create as big a picture as anything. So in a sense, we haven't moved as fast as we think. It's one of the things you see. And so what are the things that in nearly 2 decades from 2001 haven't really changed all that much? In one sense, the media is still doing what it did in 2001, scaring us all to death with images on global television.
That's true. One of the big differences is that were 9/11 to happen now, we wouldn't all be watching it on the same television shows. We'd be watching it on our phones. And already I would say there'd be conspiracy theories coming up on people's Twitter accounts saying, well, maybe these pictures aren't real. We're kind of in the realm of fake news, and it's in probably most people would watch it on Channel 9, 10, 7, 2 or SBS. But the whole experience of watching things, experiencing things, except for sport, has become much more fragmented, and I think that is a shift. But it's not a transformation, because we may still be watching the same images on our own devices or whatever. And, you know, to be honest, Anne, when I was going on about the question mark in the title, I did think, well, maybe there has been more continuity than not. But in the end, and after quite a lot of, you know, thought and deliberation, while for most of us our lives have not transformed, you know, we're still doing probably the same kinds of things we would have been doing in 2001. I think the kind of the psychic weight and the impact on fear that year prompted lives within all of us, whether we realise it or not.
If 2001 was the culmination of a cycle, and you've identified that you think that we might be seeing some elements that would produce another cycle, what sort of time frame do you think that cycle takes to culminate?
I wish I knew. I'm better at looking back at predicting things. And one thing I learned from looking at newspapers for every day of that year is that no one should predict anything ever, because I would read somebody saying, you know, I don't know, the Roosters will win, or the share market will go up, or the sun will shine, and the next day that did not happen. And, you know, pundits just keep prophesizing and everyone keeps listening. That's a tough question. I wish I could, you know, have a, you know, crystal ball.
What about predictions of 1,000 years' time about what people think of John Howard and George Bush? How does that shape up?
Who knows? Probably it's better to, you know, 100 years maybe. I mean, one of the big things with the Centenary of Federation was getting people to remember Edmund Barton. That was a huge public education campaign. You know, some of you may remember the tagline, what country would forget their first prime minister? And to me, the real question was, who's the second prime minister? But I would imagine that Bush father and son will be conflated in the way that we conflate, I don't know, John Quincy Adams and, you know, his son. Who knows? Howard, I think, will be remembered because he was in power for so long. It's as simple as that. He was around for a long time.
Jeffrey.
Philippa, do you think that one of the consequences of the 9/11 event was that we've now got probably much worse quality world leaders than we had before then? For example, if you compare George Bush Sr., who deliberately didn't go into Iraq,
with his son. You compare, say, Major with the cautious, whatever his name was, who succeeded the British Prime Minister, who succeeded Major.
Blair
with Major, for example. You've got sort of very moderate leaders who have now been succeeded by leaders who sort of make decisions off the cuff. Do you think that may have been a consequence of 9/11, or is it just accidental that we happen to have now a very inferior group of world leaders?
Yeah, that's a hard question, because you could argue that leaders respond to the times they're in, and many people would say that those times demanded a different kind of leadership. And Americans certainly got a different kind of leadership from George W. Bush. A lot of people have been, I think, lionising George W. Bush in comparison with Trump. You know, saying, well, at least George W. Bush didn't set out to trash a lot of key institutions. I think that's actually a pretty difficult argument to prosecute, because there's a lot of evidence that George W. Bush did exactly that. I don't know. There were bad leaders then, let me tell you. You know, not just, you know, the usual roundup of dictators and murderers, you know, like, for example, Mugabe in Zimbabwe at that time. Like, Berlusconi, I think, is a kind of precursor to a lot of the leaders we have now. And in a way, he seems like a buffoon. He seems comic. He was a real estate tycoon and a reality television star. You know, so Trump may have got a few ideas about what could be possible from him. But he was a strong man and very much spoke that kind of language, and we see that language coming from all kinds of people. Then Putin was in power in 2001. He's been there a long time. And I would say that, you know, the Putin we saw in 2001 is the same Putin we see now. So to answer your question, I think leaders respond to their times, and these have been a very particular set of circumstances that we hadn't seen for decades before 9/11.
You mentioned that you thought there had been a number of missed opportunities in the Arabic world prior to 2001. Can you identify two or three of what you had in mind, and what you think may have flowed had those opportunities been taken?
Yeah, it's difficult because I don't pretend to be, you know, a scholar of Islam or the Arabic world, but when I was writing the book, I read so many accounts of Western scholars, I guess, like Bernard Lewis, who talked about the clash of civilizations, which was very controversial, and kind of fit into a narrative that evolved after 9/11 in, I think, a very simplistic and not very helpful way. If we'd made more effort to be more engaged with the Arabic world in the West, things may have been different. So one example of this is that after 9/11, Americans realised, I think, they had maybe two Arabic speakers in their State Department, and that was a real problem when you were trying to get the Arab world on board, you know, in your fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And it was the same here. So there was, I think, a level of ignorance that a lot of fearmongers, to be really frank, could prey on both sides. You know, so, for example, the images that became famous of Palestinians rejoicing in the streets after 9/11 were, in fact, quite contained, but a lot of misinformation spread at the time, saying they were widespread across the Arabic world, and you know, a lot of research that has happened since then shows that wasn't necessarily the case. So there were opportunities to build bridges in general, you know, of cultural, political, military kinds in various countries, and I'm speaking about the Arab world as if it's a homogenous mass, and it's clearly not. But, yeah, a lot of chickens came home to roost.
Just a final question. What's it like being edited by someone else, and having done this first substantial book, were you inclined to do another one, or do you go back to editing other people, and what's the future hold?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, Jared, I loved it. My publisher, Meredith, from Penguin Random House, is here, and with her colleague, Catherine Knight, who edited the book, it felt like a gift, a really wonderful opportunity to be read and listened to so closely. So I loved that side of the collaboration very much, so much that I think I would like to do it again, but writing a book is a big effort and it takes a long time, so it won't be immediate. But I have really very much enjoyed the... Well, it's not... A transition makes it sound permanent. I'm still a publisher, but I liked playing for the other team too.
Well, many thanks to Philip McGuinness. As I said, we've got copies of The Year Everything Changed, 2001. As you can see from tonight, I mean, there's a huge amount of work gone into this book, a huge amount of research, and a lot of things happen in a year, particularly when you're looking internationally, not just nationally, and they're all covered here in a very sort of challenging and interesting way. So thanks for coming along tonight and telling us the story about writing the book and the story about 2001 as you saw it. I'm sure there'll be another one there, but for tonight... Congratulations and good luck.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.